Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us back here on The Mark Steiner Show. Reminding you on our way to this conversation, The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, has helped its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. And also, what we didn't do at the top of the last hour, I want to do right now, just very quickly, just to remember somebody who was a very special human being. I saw my friend Avon Bellamy's Facebook page, passed away, a man named Clinton Shorty Buse. Many people don't know Shorty. Many people do know Shorty. Shorty was one of those classic hustlers from back in the day on Pennsylvania Avenue. As Avon wrote about him, meeting at the Jewelry Hawaii in 1953-54, how he just was so brilliant, and this turned his life and people's lives around, became this weight trainer, running, teaching boxing. He has this instant recall memory, earned several degrees, really, as Avon wrote about him, we never ran from a fight. He was a giant crammed into a pint-sized body. He was my mother from another mother. He's being buried today, so our respects go out to Shorty Buse and his family and all the people who knew and loved him. Want to bring that out in the air today so he's not forgotten, and he won't be. We're going to talk about what's going on in the United States Congress here and in our government. 410-319-8888 is the number. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. From the Affordable Care Act to TPP, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, which we're not talking very much about. We are joined by phone right now by Dr. Ann McCarthy, Dean of the Business School at Hamline University in Minneapolis and former Republican candidate for Comptroller of Maryland. Yes?
Hi.
Ann, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good to have you with us. And our friend Edward Wyckoff Williams, author, columnist, political economic analyst, former investment banker, contributing editor to The Root. His column, Elevating the Dialogue, is featured on The Griot, The Root, and Slate. He writes in The Washington Post as well, and many other places. And Edward, good to have you with us.
A pleasure to be with you, Mark.
And I guess Bob Somerville will be here shortly, editor of The Daily Howler, also scheduled to join us here on this program today. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So politically, I'd like to hear what people think out there. I want to hear what you all think. I mean, this is when you look at the political part of this for a moment. When you look at the Affordable Care Act, and the blowback. It's interesting. The New York Times here this morning had a really interesting article just about that. The same kind of thing happened in 1989 with it when the Medicare laws parts were being reframed and. The blowback then. But Ann McCarthy, what does this blowback say to you?
It says to me a couple things. That people are impatient, but also they were promised one thing, and it turns out that it's not true, and it's at the face of that that makes them very upset. The other thing, though, is that it's blowback by a very small number of people, given that most of us who are in employer health insurance, nothing's changing. But it's blowback by people who tend to be independents, you know, the small business owners, the entrepreneurs, the people who make a difference in next year's election. Although they're going to have this change right next year during the middle of the election, I don't think so. So I don't know what's going on at some level.
Edward, you wrote an interesting piece about Medicaid, but I'm curious what you see as this overall effect of all this and what is really happening. What's underpinning all this, do you think?
I think underpinning the backlash is the propaganda war that the Republicans have waged against the Affordable Care Act since its inception and then its passage. Even before it began being implemented, they said that there were going to be death panels. They were scaring people on Medicare, older people on Medicare, saying that they would lose their Medicare, that doctors would decide who lives and who dies. It got very insidious, obviously, during the 2010 midterm elections, and then the Tea Party took over. And ever since, obviously, I think that this is a political war aimed at trying to walk back the progress that comes with the first African-American president. But then beyond that, it shows that there is still a huge entrenchment of power in the hands of corporate entities and insurance companies and their operatives within the GOP. I think you have basically a whole lot of sides that sometimes are invisible. So you have the Republican Party, who is out there incessantly waging a war of words, a propaganda war. But then what's happening in those back rooms is that deals are being cut to get insurance companies the kind of deals they wanted. And sadly, it seems like Obama was backed into a corner on this last point that he had to retract on, which is if you like the insurance you have, then you can get to keep it. But so many people are so ignorant and don't understand that the insurance that they had was not insurance at all. And so a part of what the Affordable Care Act was designed to do was to provide the kinds of services, just basic insurance coverage services and healthcare services that any human being would need. And so I think that's what we're dealing with. It's a hodgepodge of all of these things.
I would disagree. First of all, the insurance companies are benefiting from the Affordable Care Act more than anybody else. But the other thing is that I think the Obama administration didn't understand that, yes, most people are going to want better coverage, but a lot of people out there are the kind of risk takers that say, I'll pay out of pocket for, you know, preventable health care, for this and that, and I will only use my insurance for catastrophic occurrences, which a lot of people, you know, can rightly say, and that's not being underinsured.
But you're missing a key point.
Let me let Ann finish her thought, Edward, and then okay. Jump right in. Then we're getting, Bob's going to be with us as well, editor of the Daily Howler. Go ahead, Ann, then go back to Edward, then to Bob.
I was going to say, lots of people like their high deductible insurance policies. I myself have a high deductible insurance policy because I think insurance is there for extreme cases, not for every day. But I'm not trying to force that choice on anyone else. The point is that the administration, by designating a certain kind of insurance as acceptable or not acceptable, took choice out of people's hands. And that choice really hurt people who tend to be independent and are neither Democratic or Republican, are a little upset right now. They've handed the Republicans a little victory here that the Republicans had no idea was coming at some level.
Well, I doubt that they didn't see this coming. A part of what I don't like about Ann's perspective on this is that she is someone with a high deductible who can clearly afford it. And the whole point of the Affordable Care Act was to cover people who can't afford it. That's the whole point. There is, I think, 47.9 million people in poverty in this country and 148 who are either in poverty or low income. And so a part of the piece that I wrote last week, Mark, which you obviously liked, which is why you asked me on, is to talk about the successes of Obamacare. The huge expansion of Medicaid is covering hundreds of thousands of people so far and will cover millions eventually. That's really where Obama's success is, but that's not something talked about because we spend so much time in our political debate talking about the quote-unquote middle class. The middle class is shrinking. Those in poverty are growing, and they cannot afford high deductibles. They don't have health care insurance.
They can opt for lower deductible. I mean, the point is choice. And right now what people are upset about is that one set of choices was taken away from them. Not all the people.
And that's some people. That's a very small percentage of the American public, though.
It's a very small percentage that's getting paid a lot of attention to, and it's amazing to me because think about it. If Obama didn't backtrack, now if he just stood firm, it would blow over probably
it
by January, and we would
that.
Be on to the
agree.
Next thing. But because he backtracked, for a whole year, it's going to come up next year right
during the midterm
election time.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Bob Sonnenby, your thoughts. Welcome.
Thank you. I didn't hear the beginning. I'm sorry. I went to the wrong venue. So I'm picking up on where you are. My view on what's happened with the Affordable Care Act is it's just an astonishing failure of performance that the website is the way it is. I mean, really astonishing. And then you have, of course, added on the question of how forthright President Obama was with the issue that's under discussion. And, you know, we can discuss forever what would have been the best way to set up a health care plan, but it really is a problem that that there was a bit of a slight problem with the forthrightness, and no one's really denying that. I watched Nancy Pelosi yesterday on Meet the Press. Boy, she may have 3,000 tremendous skills behind the scenes, and I presume she does, but she is a terrible Sunday guest. And her, and, no, I'm serious, you know, which, fine, no one's good at everything.
Right.
But her attempt to explain, or to fail to explain, why she herself had said, if you like your insurance, you can keep it. Boy, it was painful to watch, and it's just very, very bad for progressive interests that this is spilling out this way. It's just a bad thing all around.
But then there are states like Kentucky. I interviewed Governor Steve Beshear of Kentucky, partly because I think it's fascinating. He is a Democratic governor in an extremely red state, and has masterfully reached the working class poor and just those in rural poverty who are completely disconnected from a lot of services. And they have done a masterful job of signing people up, not just for the Medicaid expansion, but also the private insurance exchange. And that's partly because they're the only southern state to actually do both the Medicaid expansion and the private insurance exchange. And so when you have, as people are talking about the fact that the website is not working, that's partly because when Obama and the Democrats first envisioned this, they thought that the state would take on the initiative, like a state like Kentucky has, to implement both the private exchange and the Medicaid expansion. When that did not happen, when you had 26 states in this country reject the Medicaid expansion and or setting up their own exchange, that put a great deal of pressure on the federal government. And I guess basically it's true, yes, they weren't prepared for that, and that's a problem. But you also saw at every level of our political discourse over the last, 3 years, Republicans systematically trying to defund that actual project. And so I think it's ridiculous that all of this is being blamed on President Obama, one. But two, like Ann said, that people are just so impatient that they don't understand that, one, you're going to have time to do this. Yes, this rollout is a bit of a mess, but it's happening. And at the state level, it's actually doing extremely well. And I would rather us have a more balanced debate about this as opposed to taking on Republican talking points, which most Democrats have done. Like, I think it's why Nancy Pelosi bumbled her interviews. Like, people have they have all bought into the GOP's narrative on Obamacare, and it's quite destructive.
Well, Governor Beshear and two other Democratic governors have an op-ed in today's Washington Post explaining the way they've administered and rolled out the ACA in their three states. And there's no question that states that were interested in taking part and actively took part and did so in a competent way, there's no question those states are enrolling people and the system is moving forward in those states. But it should not have been shocking given the sad state of our national discourse.
Yes.
And given the sad state of our polarization, it should not have been, in fairness, it should not have been shocking that a number of states were not going to take part. And the situation is as it is. It's really, it's a terrible technical failure. I mean, of course, it can be fixed, and eventually it will be fixed, presumably. But it's a kind of a two-shot there with the technical failure and the slight failure of forthrightness. It just creates a very bad situation. It's just a bad thing.
And I have a question for all of you about two questions about the healthcare piece that I want to hear what our listeners are thinking at 410-319-8888 about the Affordable Care Act. But Ann, go ahead.
Well, I can't say that it wasn't a technical failure, but I will say this. The Kathleen Sebelius oversaw something that she should have probably been more hands-on with, and she should have asked for, quite frankly, somebody like Jeff Bezos to come in with his tech people and fix or set up for to begin with. The biggest problem is at the last minute they made the decision that in order to be shopping on the health exchange, they had to verify your income and sort of verify who you are and all of that. If they just let shoppers, be shoppers, you know, lurking shoppers before they hit the let me check out and start my shopping cart, then none of this would have happened because it's all of that traffic that's slowing down the capability of the bandwidth to deal with all these people who are being who have to be verified in order to go on to the next step. Our Minnesota is like Kentucky. Our local, you know, marketplace is working quite well, except when we have to go out and hook up with the government's verification of social security number and income and all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, I agree with, I understand. On the other hand, I'm going to go back to, you know, this is a major rollout. This is a, just because we put a man on the moon doesn't mean we're always going to do everything perfectly. And could we have a little patience with each other?
We've proven that.
Well, let me go to the phones here.
I bet a lot of those men we sent to the moon are having second thoughts now after they see the way we're doing other things.
410-319-8888. Jay, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Only way to fix this problem is very easy, very, very easy. Just remove the mandatory part of this, then it will be fixed. Everybody will be happy. This is just one shot. If they don't make it mandatory, whosoever want it, they can have insurance. Whosoever don't want it, they will be exempted and there will be no fine. No fine. No fine at all. This is open choice. So let's fix it. That's the only thing. It's very easy. No complication.
Okay.
That's my point is. Yes.
Jay, thanks for that point. But Edward, one of the things, the problem I think with that point is that is kind of a perspective going on now in the House in terms of the bill to say to take that off. But if it's not mandatory, however you feel about the ACA, support it or don't support it, if the mandatory part isn't there, then it guts the entire financial underpinning of the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, and it basically what it was intended to do was to not just cover everyone, but to do so cost-effectively and to begin to bring down premiums. And if you don't require everyone to be in it, then that won't happen, and we will still see skyrocketing insurance prices. But what that also there's another level of, I hate to call it ignorance, but that's what it is, to that point. And it sort of underscores something that Mitt Romney said during the presidential campaign in 2012, when he said, well, everybody is covered in America. Everyone can go to the emergency room. And people don't realize that just because you choose not to be covered does not mean you won't get sick or that your family members won't get sick. And so you have to be covered. That's the whole point. That's why European nations answered this with just universal health care coverage paid for by the state, because we are human beings, and we will all die. And so you have to create a system to protect people and to even help them live longer, healthier lives. Like, this is nonsensical to say that we as the richest nation in the world, shouldn't have a system to take care of people.
I agree from a different point of view. The minute, because it creates a moral hazard, and that is that the people who do not take on coverage, the rest of us end up paying for that person, and that person gets
exactly
care. And the minute the Congress voted, I don't know how many decades ago, at least 20 years ago, that if somebody went into an emergency room and did not have health care or health insurance, the emergency room could not turn them away.
Yes, Ronald Reagan signed that into law.
The minute they made that law, they should have required everybody to have insurance.
Yeah,
Bob, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, and here's the problem behind this: insurance and the notion of universal insurance, universal coverage. It's all built on the notion, a very sensible notion, the very sensible notion that we're all in this together. But we don't live right now in a we're all in this together type of country. We're in the total opposite of that. We're in a country which is badly polarized, where large portions of the country very much feel we're not all in this together, and they don't want all being this together. We had Ron Paul a couple weeks ago talking about maybe we should just go back to being 83 different republics. That's the kind of country we're in, and I think it's very, very sensible to say, you know what, we're all in this together, and that's what nations, developed nations all over the world have built their health systems around, that perspective. But we're not, we're in the most not all in it together country ever hatched at this point. And that's why all those states are refusing to take part and blah, 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 blah. And people are running for re-election on the idea, hey, hooray, I stood up to the thought that people might get more health coverage in this state. So that's the kind of situation we're in. And it's a very, very difficult situation. And you can't ask President Obama or any other individual political leader to snap his fingers and make a magical speech and make that go away. That's the world we're living in right now.
410-319-8888. Your thoughts on this, on the Affordable Care Act, where we are in America, what your own experiences are. And Tyrone, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Very well. Welcome.
I heard someone on your panel mention that 47.9 million people don't have health care or health coverage.
Or in poverty is what it would say.
And the middle class is shrinking, meaning poverty is growing. For those people that don't have health care or can't afford it, what do you do with all those people? I mean, just no health care for them whatsoever, or do you come up with type of solution that will make this system work for even the poor people?
Well, I mean, part of the Health Care Act was supposed to, the ACA was supposed to cover those without health care. I mean, 37 million Americans, 37% of all Americans, adults, did not go with health care in the last year, did not go get recommended health care because they didn't have the insurance. This is ACA is supposed to cover that, but now states can opt out because the Supreme Court said that they can opt out. So there will be a lot of people still uninsured in America, and those states are going to be caught in the kind of the biggest bind of all, Bob. I mean, I think that that's
And it's such a Rube Goldberg scheme, and I don't say that again to criticize President Obama or anyone else, but it's the attempt to keep the insurance companies in it, and the attempt to because we're not in a we're all in this together type of nation. We're forced to create these hopelessly complex schemes. There's no way around that. Whereas, you know, other developed nations have much simpler arrangements. And in fact, Medicare for All, let's use that as a sort of a catchphrase. And we're left with these complicated, you know, no one can explain the Affordable Care Act. I mean, it's really kind of amazing that 3 years went by and no one discussed the fact that everyone wasn't going to be able to keep their health coverage if they liked it. I mean, and now everyone's shocked about this. I mean, but it's just, we have no viable discussion that goes on, and we're trying to do a super complex scheme because we can't just do simple single payer. We have a very difficult situation in this country. We're a mess.
Edward, on that note, we're going to take a brief break, and you can come back and bring that up as soon as we come back, what you're about to say. And we're going to go out with Hank Ballard's and the Midnighters, The Twist. This is the day he was born. This is the man who brought us The Twist originally, before Chubby Checker even. Hank Ballard, The Twist.
Around me, everybody, gather around me while I preach some. Feel a sermon coming on me. The topic will be sin, and that's what I'm again. If you wanna
and settle back and just sit tight.
Welcome back. Accentuate the Positive by Johnny Mercer and the Pied Pipers. Can we do it? I'm not sure. Bob Somerby's with us, editor of the Daily Howler, Dr. Ann McCarthy, dean of the business school at Hamline University in Minneapolis, former Republican candidate for controller, and Edward Wyckoff Williams, author, columnist, political and economic analyst, former investment banker, contributing editor to The Root. His column, Elevating the Dialogue, is featured in The Griot, The Root, and Slate, and his writings also appears in The Washington Post. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow at gmail.com. I want to get to your calls. But, Edward, you're about to say what?
I wanted to make the point, it was based to follow up to the caller's comment about the fact that there are 47.9 people in poverty. But the bigger point is that there's 148 in poverty and or low income. And one of the key points that I spoke to Governor Beshear about, and Gwenda Bond, his communications director there in Kentucky, said, which I think is really important for people to understand, is that the vast majority of the people who are entering into the insurance market now and are able to qualify for Medicaid are working people. These are not people who live off what she called the system. Because I think in the minds of so many people, when we talk about poverty and those in poverty, we think of poverty as being so distant from ourselves. But the working poor are the vast majority of these people who have one or two or sometimes three jobs but still don't make enough to be able to take care of themselves and their families and to afford things which, like have literally almost become a privilege, insurance. Health insurance has become a privilege in this country. That is a problem, and that's a part of what the Affordable Care Act is intended to remedy. And so I think when we talk about the website, when we talk about the glitches, when we talk about the political rancor, we really need to understand the people that are affected by either the success of this, the repeal of this, or the continued struggle and striving over this.
You know, and this is part of the problem of our patchwork health system, which is I don't know the statistics, and Mr. Williams might be able to go beyond what I can offer here. But it seems to me, am I wrong that if you're actually in poverty, you're probably more likely to be covered than if you're simply in low income?
Yes, that's exactly true.
So it's exactly. Just none of this makes any sense whatsoever, and many of the people that aren't covered are the hardest working people in the United States, the people who keep the society functioning. They're not paid enough on their jobs, which is a problem of the overall drift of our income distribution. But they're not, as Mr. Williams has said, they're not the poverty people. They're the working low-income people, and our patchwork system makes so little sense. And it's easy to understand why people don't understand this around the country. It's inherently confusing.
Ann, please jump in on this, and I'm going to ask another question.
Go ahead and ask another question. I'm just agreeing with these two guys, Edward and Bob.
Well, very quickly, before I ask you all a question about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I really want to talk about for a minute here on the air, and because it's so little covered, it's been so little covered in the press that I have not seen a lot, but it's part of the root of this act itself. I mean, the confusion. I mean, I think that President Barack Obama has to carry some of the weight for making the statements about no one will lose their coverage without realizing that they would. I think that was a huge mistake on their part. And also, just think and organizing it so that the disasters around the computers did not take place. It seems to me that there was a real lack somehow of organization here and thinking about how this rollout was actually going to work. I mean, I think, Bob, that's part of the issue, and that also leads to the political question that's taken all the weight off of the Tea Party for what just occurred on Capitol Hill now being thrown back in the Democrats' lap.
Well, I mean, the failure of the site to work plays into the oldest conservative talking point of all time, which is the federal government never did anything right. I mean, this is... You couldn't have invented this. If you were an evil genius running the world as a conservative god, you couldn't have invented a better illustration of this talking point, which, of course, is not true. And, you know, private industry screws things up all the time. Everyone screws things up all the time. But this is the fundamental talking point that has been offered for decades that the federal government can't do anything right. And here's the federal government failing to do something right. I mean, it's a horrible illustration of a standard talking point.
It is unfortunate. But I would remind us all that the federal government built the very internet that every single one of us depends on. That worked really well most.
I agree. I'm just saying this so totally reinforces a talking point, which is misleading. It's not the case that the federal government can't do anything right. It doesn't do everything right, and neither does private industry. But
it
totally reinforces the talking point.
I agree. But I think it's unfortunate. Who told – okay, the president of the United States does not possibly know every single little detail that goes on everywhere over in the country, much less what his administration is responsible for. No one man can do that. No one woman can do that. Who told – somebody must have told him when they put together the ACA that nobody was going to lose their insurance if they didn't – if they liked it. Everybody who liked their insurance could keep it. Somebody had to have told them that and had to have given them the reasons why. And that person should be looking for a new job.
I'm not as nihilistic on this. I think that these things will be worked out, but I'm also encouraged by the numbers that came out on Thursday. I think over 100,000 people have already signed up and chosen their actual plans on the exchange. That's despite the glitches. Over 300,064 people have entered into the Medicaid exchange successfully. They're already in. These are people who actually are just already covered now. And I think the projection was that about 500,000 would be added over the next month. Now, mind you, those numbers are just for the first month. Yes, there are millions of unemployed people, but it takes time to understand the plans, to choose the right plan. The people who are getting these letters now, granted, there's now going to be more confusion. And I agree with Ann on the point that had Obama not walked back, this would have just blown over as another news cycle event, and the plan would have gone forward. But be all that as it may, this is working, and it's certainly working in the states where governors and their teams actually care about their constituents and are making it work. And I don't know what the future holds for the 26 states that haven't signed on. I don't know what the political fallout will be. It'll be interesting to see how 2014 goes. But no matter what happens here, more Americans being covered, particularly more poor people being covered, is a very, very, very good thing.
410-319-8888. And Linda in Hamilton, you're on the air.
I just want to make two points. Obama compromised in order to get this bill. So this is a very watered-down version of what was wanted, and it's far, far from universal health care. But one of the things that kind of gets me is that, you know, after compromising with the insurance companies to get this bill passed, they, in a sense, have pulled the rug out from under him now and embarrassed him by canceling people's policies. So I don't think they had any intentions of playing along in the first place. And I don't know why he won't come out and say, I didn't cancel your policies, they did. And the policies that you had weren't that great in the first place. And the second thing is that most people have not read the entire bill. And one thing that a lot of people are totally unaware of is that there is a provision for setting up these health care exchanges. Organizations can get together and do this. And basically, if enough people in this country read the bill, set up health care exchanges, they can basically put the insurance companies out of business. The insurance companies are middlemen. We don't need them. The same thing, you know, with banks. You don't have to use a commercial bank. You can use credit unions. People need to stop thinking in terms of alternatives. And people are not doing that. People need to start thinking outside of the box. That's my comment.
Thank you, Linda, for your comment.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Thoughts on this? Bob?
I pretty much agreed with her, but I don't have anything to add.
I would say that the part of the problem that we don't realize is that we don't have one Blue Cross Blue Shield and one Kaiser Permanent. We don't have major corporations competing against each other in the insurance market. We have 50 monopolies, each regulated by 50 different states. And those 50 little monopolies in each of those little states are uncontrollable in some sense, except by the state. So I understand her point, and I agree that we need to start thinking outside the box. On the other hand, the whole insurance market is so complex, and nobody wants to really take that on.
Right, and there are very powerful interests that are basically running the government, and it's not just an act of whimsy that a political leader like Obama decides to work with these interests, because they're very powerful, and they're very powerful within both parties. The one thing I'd say that it keeps occurring to me as we're having this conversation, for progressives who want to build a future where it's easier to get this sort of social progress done, I'm thinking back to talking points from the previous Democratic administration, President Clinton. President Clinton had a pretty good sense of where the average person was, and his talking points were often all about getting people to feel we're all in this together. We don't have a single person to waste. I'm here for the people who work hard and play by the rules. Progressives have to develop a sense in the country that we're not warring factions, that we're all one people, and that's going to be very difficult to do, but that's until we move back in that direction, it's going to be very hard to build more progressive entities in the country.
It seems like Obama has successfully done that in his run in 2008 and his reelection in 2012. He built this rainbow coalition of liberal whites, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, and gays. And it seems like his message has been winning, but the political war he loses because, frankly, he's not willing to lie and use propaganda tactics the way that Republicans have. And they're playing redemptive era politics here. They are literally trying to walk back racial progress in this country, and they see him as the face of that. And so I think when we talk about everything related to this president, it becomes extremely complicated to act as if he is existing in a normal political environment. He is not. Washington is at war because he is African-American and because the Republican Party is hell-bent on staying in power.
Well, but
that's a problem.
I take a little nuanced view of that. And Chris Christie is like a great example here. He's the first Republican who's finally standing up to the Tea Party and saying, you know what, I'm not playing your game.
But you know, he wouldn't be reelected if he didn't do that. This is a man from the state of New Jersey, so.
Yeah, but, you know, part of the problem is that Republicans won't stand up against the Tea Party because then they lose their primaries. You know, so many long-term moderate senators and Congress representatives have lost their primary to Tea Party representatives that frequently can't even go on and beat the Democrat that they compete against.
Well, no, but there's one of the issues we didn't get a chance to talk about, which we have in the last 14 minutes here, we'll try to wrestle with when we talk about the openness of this administration in Congress, is this Trans-Pacific Partnership, which nobody's talking about. Which we remember through NAFTA, people said all these, what NAFTA was going to do, create jobs in America, and NAFTA was going to do this for America, which it didn't, did the opposite. And we are watching this being negotiated by this administration in secrecy with 14 other governments that some people, when they saw what WikiLeaks put out, could actually, some people are arguing now, we don't know because we don't know enough about it, but could possibly limit our intellectual freedom, could strengthen the hand of insurance companies and around intellectual property, could strengthen pharmaceuticals and our ability to get health care, could actually do things like supersede, some people are arguing, and we don't know enough to even know if it's true, arguing that our national courts around issues of intellectual property and pharmaceuticals and who has the right to sell what. And so it feels as if we are being sold a bill of goods, especially since this is not being allowed to be done in the open. So what are our thoughts on this? And we'll do longer shows on this.
I think it might be important to explain what the TPP is. Can you do that in layman's terms, Mark?
In layman's terms, well, from what I understand, the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Your TP does not stand for Tea Party. Let's say that.
No, it doesn't. But there are Tea Party members and progressive members of Congress who are saying, I've put the hold on ratifying this because we don't know enough about it. This is this is an agreement between the United States and 14 other nations around the Pacific Rim that represent 40% of the world's domestic product that will allow companies to trade and develop products have their around the world without having to worry about certain national laws that exist now that will supersede those laws.
Without having to worry about trademarks and that kind of thing, sort of intellectual property rights, essentially, so that they won't be sued. And it essentially relaxes those laws for that group of nations, largely to assist in the emerging trade between them, right? And so I think from the White House perspective, and I am not at all an expert on this, but just from a layman's perspective, this is how I see it. I think the White House sees this because, remember, the White House has been pivoting to Asia because they see Asia as being the growing force in the world, right, economic and military. And so they believe that they need trade agreements with these Asian nations as they emerge out of the third world into the developing world. It seems that by relaxing these trademark laws, you basically – major companies like U.S. companies and European companies won't be able to stifle business in those nations. And so that's a part of what is attractive from the perspective of these countries. We're talking about Singapore and Brunei. New Zealand was one of the original who signed on. Australia, Vietnam, Malaysia. These countries are interested in this because – it would allow them to do business in arenas that they haven't been able to do because they didn't own the copyright or they didn't own the trademark.
The other part, though, if you read that, all I know is what I've been hearing people argue in Congress at the moment. All I know is what I've seen from the WikiLeaks documents that I've read. But what things that have been leaked out are saying this, because this, to quote from the act itself, the leaked chapter suggests that you could do things like drug companies would be able to extend and widen their patents, prohibiting other countries from producing life-saving pills, stopping certain surgeries, not allowing you to go anywhere else to buy your prescriptions. It would kind of allow both the Hollywood music industry and IT companies like Microsoft and pharmaceuticals to kind of control all the kind of copyrights across the globe the way they want. I mean, and would be a detriment to the smaller entrepreneur, be a detriment to people around the world who are trying to do to around these copyright issues about what you can download, can't download. And the idea that this is being done without any public scrutiny, to me, is very troubling.
And there's very, very little, I looked over the weekend, Mark. There's very little press coverage, even in the biggest national newspapers. And if you think about how difficult it is to get a coherent discussion going about something like healthcare, which is a very tangible activity which everyone is familiar with from actual living, if you think about how hard it is to get a sensible discussion of that going when there's been tremendous focus on that area for years, the idea that we're ever going to have a sensible discussion of the TPP in a situation where it's really not being covered in the newspapers at all, and it's a highly arcane matter. By the way, China is one of those other 14 countries, and that's a pretty big country. So, you know, that's part of this whole deal. But there's going to be no discussion of this that anyone understands, and all those powerful interests are going to be involved in whatever is negotiated. They will be following the discussion.
But this is also a trade barrier. It's not just about trademarks and intellectual property. It's also about trade barriers such as quotas and tariffs and things like that, correct?
Right.
Yeah, it is.
Right.
And Mexico is also one of the signatories, and Mexico believes it'll make, you know, do well under this, under the TPP. I would say this about it. Part of what this is, and I agree that there's no discussion about it, and so there's a lot of misunderstanding or just lack of knowledge about it. Yet it will affect us. Is that it's an anti-piracy, anti-knockoff? Well, a portion of it. Anti-piracy and anti-knockoff. And if you listen just this morning to the number of even drugs that are coming into the United States that don't even have any active ingredients, including cancer drugs, because they're knockoffs. They're not really pirated, but they're fake. And this, the TPP is trying to, in some sense, address that fact, that right or wrong, some Asian countries and some Asian Asian companies make branded goods, put the brand on them, and yet have nothing of the quality of the brand underneath them. And yet consumers go out and buy those branded goods thinking they're getting one drug or one kind of pocketbook or one kind of software when, in fact, they're getting a shell. So that is, I think that's a good part of the TPP, but I do agree that there's no discussion about it, and that's unfortunate.
Well, I see. I think, and there's no discussion about it. And I get, one of my fears is that the same way I look at the Affordable Care Act in some ways, that this was a bill that, while it covers more people than ever did before in the United States of America, was a bill written by and for, in many ways, the insurance industry that really kind of, this is their bill. This is not too dissimilar from Romney's bill back in the 90s or what Gingrich pushed in the 90s when Clinton was trying to push health care reform. It really isn't that different. And that some people look at this, and I think it deserves kind of a deeper look. The TPP is the increasing power and aggrandizement of power from the corporate end of the world.
Yeah.
And I think that's what people are worried about.
Okay, I'll present my standard presentation here, which is, the 1% is going to be in control of everything as long as the 99% are split into red and blue tribes and are arguing about every kind, arguing over every kind of issue down here on the plains, while up on the lofty mountaintops, that's divide and conquer is what the 1% have always thought, and that's the nature of the system we're operating in right now. And the 1% doesn't take any day off. They're busy, and they follow discussions, and they're involved in discussions.
And what we do know is that it covers everything from intellectual property rights to issues between competitive and state-owned properties, environmental policies, investment policies internationally, procurement. I mean, these are, for a lot of the world in the press, because the press is so dumbed down now, these are boring issues, but they're not. They're life and blood issues about where the world's going and who's going to control it. I think these are things that we're letting slip away without kind of really demanding to know what's going on.
I agree. And part of it is that when the news cycle is all about whether or not the U.S. government is shutting down or not raising its debt ceiling or the technical fiascos, nothing like this that's truly important and long range tends to rise to the top. So, Marcus, good thing that you at least gave us 14 minutes.
Well, we're going to do more than that in the coming weeks so we can talk about this, because I think that there are people in the U.S. Congress who are raising issues which have now put off the ratification of anything until we know more. And I think that and again, it's been both progressive elements and the Tea Party elements for varying reasons who are kind of pushing this. But again, the press isn't covering anything, as Bob always used, as you like to wax about, which I think is important. We don't have the press to do their work anymore.
Well, no, there's very little coverage of this topic even being attempted. Now, there are topics where you get a flood of coverage, which is basically unhelpful, but this is a topic where there's essentially no coverage going on at all.
So, I mean, Edward, just your thought on this as well. I mean, does this disturb you?
I can't say that I know enough about the details of it. What I've seen so far, it appears that though the aim is to open up trade between these countries, these emerging economies, right? A part of the trade-off is that corporations might end up having more expensive power to challenge environmental and consumer protections and all this other stuff,
right.
Which basically allows them to maintain power and even grow their own power abroad outside of the nations in which they originated their business. But be all that as it may, the good thing is the Occupy movement was involved in rallying against this. Open media has done a lot of coverage on it, just from an internet perspective. And I think people like you are breaking it down in layman's terms for the broader audience to begin to have some knowledge about this and consider whether or not they want to be in touch with their congressmen and get involved in the debate. I'm not quite sure if this is a bad thing or a good thing. I can't make that decision because I simply have not done the research. But I can say that it's important for us to be talking about stuff besides the random talking point on Sunday shows and whatever the latest GOP scandal is or what Kim Kardashian is doing. You know what I mean? I think that what's important is that we are having reasonable nuance and informed debate, and you are responsible for that, and thank you, as you're educating all of us.
Well, we're going to come back to this a great deal more and kind of see where all this is. And I appreciate the three of you always being willing to come on the show and have these conversations from a varying perspectives. It's always good to have you. And Bob Somerby, editor of the Daily Howler, always great to have you on the air with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Dr. Ann McCarthy, dean of the Business School and Hamline, University of Minneapolis, always good to have you with us as well.
Same here, Mark.
And the increasingly widely read Edward Wyckoff Williams.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Good to have you all with us. Thank you all for you so much for the conversation today.
All right, buddy.
All right, take Bye-bye. Care. Thank you all for joining us and writing in and calling in and bringing your ideas to the airwaves as well. Good to have you all here on the show with us, as always, bringing your stuff to the airwaves. And we'll see you tomorrow morning with brand new ideas at 9 a.m. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Welcome back to Mark Gunnery, who's been off. Back now with us. Good to have him here across the glass. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our intern is Tashira Smith. To hear this show again, podcast and our past shows, find out about our guests and what they've been writing and talking about, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also see the full day in history at steinershow.org as well. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts now on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Stay tuned now for Michelle Martin and tell me more. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.